supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is using his final year in office to confront the problem of drug addiction. WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports his latest efforts include TV ads and tackling drugs in prison.
Last week, the Christie administration rolled out radio and TV ads around its new addiction campaign, Reach NJ. This one features a woman named Vanessa who got hooked on painkillers after an injury.
By the time the drugs ran out, I was addicted. It happened so fast. I ended up on the streets where the drugs are cheaper and easier to get. I was a full-blown heroin addict, selling my soul to get high.
The ad directs drug users to a state website or phone hotline where they can get help finding treatment services. And this week, Christie reopened a shuttered state correctional facility, but with a new purpose. It will become the state's first drug treatment prison. Christie says drug abuse is often the root cause of criminal activity, but it's overlooked in jails and prisons.
The whole idea of incarceration in the first place is not only just to keep people who have exhibited antisocial behavior off the streets to protect the folks who are following the law and following the rules on the street, but it's also supposed to be about rehabilitation.
Dan Romer at Penn's Annenberg Public Policy Center says high-profile public officials are finally recognizing that addiction is not something to be ashamed of.
And I think Christie is taking that to heart, you know, that we shouldn't treat it as, as something that reflects badly on the person other than that they have an illness.
Critics have said that Christie's plan is too little, too late, and that he'll also need to put up some money to combat drug use and knock down the stigma surrounding addiction. The two-term Republican has less than a year left in office to make it happen. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
President Donald Trump proposes cutting $2.6 billion from the Environmental Protection Agency, around one-third of the budget. Such a move could mean that state environmental agencies will have to do more with less, but State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports the DEP is already strapped.
Late last year, the EPA sent Pennsylvania a letter warning its water program was so poorly staffed it was failing to enforce federal safe drinking water standards. State inspectors aren't checking public water systems often enough.
So this is the Conestoga.
John Holden is water production supervisor for the city of Lancaster. He's standing on the banks of the Conestoga River, watching water rush into one of the city's two filtration plants. He shows off the spaghetti-like membranes that block bacteria from getting into water for 120,000 people.
This is what separates the dirty water from the clean water.
Holden says the State Department of Environmental Protection does regularly check water quality at this plant because it's so big. But he says smaller water systems, like a school in a rural area or a mobile home community, can get overlooked. And here's why that matters. It's almost always state environmental agencies that enforce federal environmental laws. And to do that, the DEP now plans to hike fees on public water systems so it can hire more inspectors.
Yeah, they probably need to raise their fees so they can do their job. They've certainly been cut over the last 10, 15 years. I've seen that.
In the past decade, the DEP has lost about 40% of its state funding and 25% of its staff.
I think the department over the last 10 or 12 years has had to do so much triage.
David Hess led the agency under former Republican Governor Tom Ridge.
In my opinion, it is very close to not being able to accomplish its mission.
He worries public health is at risk. Together, he says, Republican and Democratic administrations have cut or diverted nearly $2.5 billion away from Pennsylvania environmental programs.
That's a lot of money, and no one seemed to bat an eye about it.
Joanne Kilgour of the state chapter of the Sierra Club says an agency with a bare-bones budget is also more vulnerable to lawsuits.
It makes it very difficult for an agency to adequately carry out their duties, and that's exposure to potential liability.
Pennsylvania's problems are hardly unique. Alexander Dunn is executive director of the Environmental Council of the States, a national nonpartisan association of state environmental agency leaders.
There's not a lot of fat left in the state environmental agencies.
On average, she says, state agencies get more than a quarter of their funding from the federal government. Many faced budget crises after the Great Recession, and Dunn says they'd be hurt by more cuts.
The outcome likely will be slower issuance of permits, less monitoring of ambient environmental conditions.
The new EPA Administrator, Scott Pruitt, is defending the White House's proposed cuts. In a recent interview on Fox News, he said states can do their jobs.
You know, we have state departments of environmental quality across the country that have the resources and the expertise to deal with clean water and clean air issues.
DEP Secretary Patrick McDonald disagrees. He recently sent Pruitt a letter slamming the proposed cuts. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Next up, an apology. At the risk of raining on an otherwise beautifully sunny spring day, let's consider the hurricane season ahead with New Jersey State climatologist David Robinson. Mr. Robinson, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
My pleasure.
Now, we do have until June 1st, right? That's the onset of the season?
Right. That's the official onset. Mother Nature doesn't always cooperate. Sometimes storms come earlier. You have to wait a while for one.
So who makes the forecast, and what are the variables that go into it?
There's various groups that make the long-range outlooks looking into the hurricane season. One is the National Hurricane Center. They've not said anything lately, but there's some other groups, including a group at Colorado State, which has a long history of research into long-range hurricane forecasting. As odd as it sounds out there in the middle of the country, they're considered one of the foremost groups that have studied this for quite a while.
So what is an average number of hurricanes for the Atlantic coast in our region, and what are we bracing for?
Generally, you get 11, 12 named storms in the Atlantic basin each year, and maybe six or seven of them become hurricanes, which would mean stronger winds than just the tropical storm. The call from Colorado State is to be a little below average this year, maybe five or six storms of hurricane variety, and two of them perhaps strong hurricanes, which would be a Category 3 or higher storm with sustained winds over 110 miles an hour. So that's a little below average. It's early in the game, and it's basically tied into one indicator that's out there, believe it or not, in the tropical Pacific, and that is the El Nino phenomenon. And when you have an El Nino in progress, which is an interaction between winds and ocean temperatures in the atmosphere and ocean of the Pacific, it can have an influence over in the Atlantic basin. And the influence of an El Nino is to not permit hurricanes to percolate up through the atmosphere as effectively as in non-El Nino years.
Well, we've certainly provided fodder for conversation at the water cooler. Above and beyond that, who else might be interested in this kind of a long-term forecast?
Insurance companies and the companies that insure insurance companies. They're going to have a real interest in this because so much is on the line, and they can prepare in whatever ways they find useful if they had at least some indication. Others, for instance, Home Depot, Lowe's, companies that have a vested interest in building supplies, for instance. If they hear it's an active season, they may ramp up their orders, be ready to transfer material into stricken areas. It's not the individual homeowner or the individual community when it comes to these long-range outlooks. Rather, it's the companies that are large. And if they have just a little hedge on even odds and can hedge positively in one direction, it's going to benefit the company, or it may actually benefit the community as well.
With the season running into November, I presume the predictions become somewhat more accurate when it's reassessed in June, July, and August.
There will be another issuance of these outlooks at the start of the season. And then not only will they be able to look at El Nino, which has a longer what we call lead time, but they'll be able to look at sea surface temperatures in the Atlantic tropical oceans. They'll be able to look and see if there are active waves of low pressure coming off the African continent, which help to spawn tropical systems. They'll be able to look at dust, where there's dust coming off the Sahara that comes into the Atlantic and can also serve to cap or inhibit storm development. Those have shorter lead times that we really can't say much about now.
New Jersey State climatologist David Robinson, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
You're welcome. Anytime.
A business model that worked 70 years ago is being resurrected in Delaware by a retired Baltimore cop who's starting the Veterans Watchmaker Initiative. It's a watchmaking school exclusively for veterans, and it's about to welcome its first class, as WHYY's Shirley Min reports.
Inside an old EMT base in northern Delaware, Sam Cannon is taking apart a mechanical watch. All you can hear is the clink of tiny metal pieces being dropped into a thimble-sized cleaning basket. This is where the first class of the Veterans Watchmaker Initiative will learn the art of watch repair, free of charge.
The Veterans Watchmaker Initiative is the only technical school that teaches watchmaking exclusively for veterans in the entire country.
We're surrounded by chairs, workbench frames, and of course, watches. Everything inside has either been donated or paid for by Cannon out of his own pocket. He hopes to open by summer, if not sooner.
They need in the USA today thousands of watchmakers. The salaries are good. They could start, depending on where you live in the country, anywhere from $65,000 to $85,000 a year right out of school.
Cannon is a master watchmaker and a trained instructor. His idea to enlist veterans, especially disabled vets, is not an original one.
Disabled veterans learn the highly skilled trade of watchmaking.
After World War II, the Bulova family did the exact same thing. They opened the Bulova School of Watchmaking in 1945 in Queens, New York. It closed in 1993.
They trained an entire generation of veterans as watchmakers, and it worked then and it works now. I kind of joke about saying if you have one eye and one arm and you have the heart to do this, to overcome, we can make you a watchmaker, and you can make a good living no matter what.
Most watches sold today run on batteries. The mechanical watch he repairs is powered by a really small spring and is usually pretty expensive. Think Rolex. Demand for mechanicals took a nosedive when battery-powered quartz watches hit the market in the 80s. The quartz crisis decimated luxury watch production, and then professional watchmakers also took a hit.
Then suddenly the pendulum began to swing the other way. And what happened is that the industry suddenly realized, we don't have any watchmakers to fix all these mechanical watches that we're producing.
Cannon says the main players in the watch industry are scrambling to set up schools. But new graduates can't keep up with all the watchmakers who are retiring or dying. Watchmaking is not easy. It entails a lot more than just replacing worn-out parts.
They basically walk out of school as what's known as a micro-machinist. Any part that they need, they can create from scratch, which is the hallmark of a watchmaker.
Jason Adams is one of more than 350 veterans waiting for VWI to open its doors.
I love seeing how things work and the therapeutic side. I was reading about how it helps people with post-blast exposure on, you know, just being able to clear their minds for that few moments is just a nice thing to have when you need it.
The 35-year-old's Army unit hit an improvised explosive device during his second deployment to Iraq. He suffered a traumatic brain injury, PTSD, and shrapnel wounds. Adams was found medically unfit to serve and retired in 2010. A single blast took away the only career Adams had ever known. Years later, he still battles chronic migraines and depression. Decision-making is a struggle for him, even trying to remember to eat. Adams depends on his family every single day. When he heard about VWI, he saw it as a way for him to regain some independence.
When I was in the military, you had like this purpose, this drive. You knew you were doing your part in the society. And now that I have all these disabilities, it's like, what can I do to once again be part of, you know, our growing as a nation and society and all that together?
Rick Hoffman served in Vietnam. The 71-year-old walks with a prosthetic after losing a leg in a motorcycle accident. Hoffman fell in love with the program instantly and enrolled in the full 18-month course. He also plans to teach his fellow vets jewelry repair through the school.
There are 82% unemployment among disabled vets, 22 veterans commit suicide per day. And we need to get this place started. Because every moment we miss is we're losing somebody.
Cannon says the only qualifications to enroll is an honorable discharge. 8 veterans will make up the first class. Most of them live in Delaware. Eventually, Cannon plans to expand the school. A local family donated 4 acres of land, about a 10-minute drive from the EMT site in Odessa. He wants to build a 28,000-square-foot campus there, where 54 students could live, eat, and work.
It's become my goal in life to do this. This is what's going to happen. One way or another, it'll kill me to make this happen for these guys and gals because they need this.
From the Delaware Desk, I'm Shirley Min, WHYY News.
Ever since Pluto was demoted from the pantheon of planets, efforts have intensified to designate a replacement. Joining me with notions about a new number 9 is Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, is it beyond dispute that that elusive body is out there just waiting to be found?
It's not beyond dispute. That's the interesting aspect about this. We have been able to detect what we feel is a presence of an object that's about 10 times the mass of Earth, and it seems to be at a distance that's 1,000 times the distance between the Earth and the Sun. So that's really very, very, very far out. A group that's working at Australian National University has used a special tool called SkyMapper. It's a particular type of telescope that does surveys of the night sky. And what they've done is they've used this tool to collect hundreds of thousands of images of the night sky. However, hundreds of thousands of images, these researchers calculate, would take about 4 years to sift through. So what they did was something very ingenious. They employed a method of citizen science in which they've asked thousands of people to join on a project to sift through all these images. And guess what? 60,000 people did that sifting in 3 days. So what they've come down with now is that there are 4 candidates that are going to be looked at a bit closer.
We are some 93 million miles from Sun. You're referencing an entity 1,000 times further out than that?
We have to think of it in terms of the reach of the Sun's gravitational pull to a degree and the point at which the Sun's own solar wind, its own flow of electromagnetic particles, interfaces with interstellar space where the boundary between those two becomes very fluid. It's no longer under the influence of the Sun, but then under the influence of a region beyond.
From the vantage point of that elusive number 9, would our Sun be distinguishable from any other star in the night sky?
It might be as distinguishable from other stars in the sky as the bright star Sirius stands out in our late winter sky that we can still see now, just after sunset. But if you thought of our Sun as appearing that way, you wouldn't immediately think that, of course, there's a family of planets in orbit around that star, much in the same way that we have not heretofore thought as we've looked at other stars, that there are families of planets orbiting those.
Let's come back home, look overhead. What natural and man-made bodies are available to be seen in the night sky this week?
As it turns out, Mars is visible after sunset in the west. You have to give the Sun a chance to get down, and then Mars is visible about a half an hour later after that. Jupiter is visible over on the eastern side of the sky by 9 p.m., well up in the east and easy to see. But Jupiter, Saturn, and Venus are visible in the pre-dawn sky. 5:15 a.m., you'll find Jupiter farthest to the west. Come back a bit to the south, you'll see Saturn. And then if you move over to the east, this week, very low in the east, brilliant Venus. Its position will be improving over the next several weeks, rising higher in the sky until we'll be able to see it as high in the pre-dawn sky as we saw it in the evening sky just a few months ago. But in addition to that, there's a special treat. Tonight, starting at 9:05 p.m., over in the north-northwestern side of the sky, we have a flyby of International Space Station. And, of course, it will appear as a bright, moving dot of light tracking across the sky. It has a steady velocity with which it moves across the sky. Most interesting about this particular flyby, Peggy Whitson is an American astronaut for whom this is her 8th mission aboard International Space Station. And, in fact, just about a week and a half ago, she broke the record and set a new record for women performing spacewalks. She's now up to 53 hours, 22 minutes, exceeding the previous record of 50 hours, 40 minutes. She's decided to opt for an additional 3 months on board. She was planning to come back in June. She's now going to come back in September. And so way better as she goes by.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.